This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Apple Computer has decided to make a move that it's always resisted. It's going to allow other manufacturers to clone the Macintosh. That is, it will allow other manufacturers to duplicate the Mac operating system. My guest Stephen Levy is a computer columnist for Newsweek and the author of a book about the history of the Macintosh called Insanely Great, The Life and Times of Macintosh, the Computer That Changed Everything. He says the decision to clone may change the computer that changed everything. He told me why Apple decided to license clones.
For years, Apple has been urged by various commentators to license their operating system, which is the software that really makes the Macintosh a Macintosh, the easy-to-use way to copy files and get to files and to, get the software, no matter what the application is, to work in a very easy-to-use fashion. And finally, they've decided to do this because they're very worried that their market share is small and getting smaller. They only have between 10 and 15% of computer users using Macintoshes. So they feel by allowing clones, by letting other people license their operating system and put it on other brands of computers, they can increase their market share.
Now, what will this mean for consumers in the short run?
Well, in the short run, it might mean, if Apple finds the right partners, that they can buy the Macintosh technology, which has traditionally been a little more expensive than other kinds of computers. Actually, years ago, it was much more expensive. And so you'll be able to buy a Power Mac for probably 50% less than you could buy one now.
Why had Apple decided not to allow clones until now?
Well, the operating system, the software that makes the Macintosh, was the crown jewels of Apple. If you let other companies come out with computers that use that operating system, what would make Apple special? Why would people buy an Apple when they could buy a lower-cost computer that operates exactly the same?
So why change its mind now?
Because they're very scared that this market share, the small market share, is not going to grow. And they're particularly worried that the people who write software, who write applications like word processing or spreadsheets and other things you could do with a computer, will say, well, why even bother to write for Apple? Why write in the Macintosh operating system? Because 90% of people don't use it. So they have to keep the best software authors interested in their operating system.
Well, so few people are buying Apples now. Apple is afraid that there won't be new innovative software because the market's so small.
Exactly. I think that there are ways around this. I don't think you necessarily have to license your operating system to bring in the best people. You know, when Macintosh first started, there was, of course, zero people using the Macintosh. They had to build a user community from scratch. And what they did was they really went out and wooed developers. They had this program called the Evangelism Program. And it was like a religion. They went out and they brought the machines to people and they pampered them and they did everything so people get excited about the Macintosh and realize it could be good for their business to start with something which was brand new and very exciting and could do different things, could be more powerful. And I think they have to kind of get back to those roots and concentrate more on evangelism and getting people excited about writing for their machine to develop new things you can do with the Macintoshes. And maybe that's the way to bring in these third-party software authors.
So in the short run, at least, for consumers, this decision means that there will be cheaper copies of the Macintosh technology that's available. Do you think there's a downside to the decision to allow clones?
I definitely do. You know, right now, I think a lot of people who buy new Macintoshes are people who are upgrading their old Macintoshes. And these are people who would buy Apple technology anyway. So faced with that, if I have the option of buying a Power Mac for $2,000 from Apple and the same machine for maybe $1,200 from someone else, obviously I'm not going to give my business to Apple. Likewise, there's another problem in that if other companies are making Macintosh-style computers, they might add their own features, and sooner or later, you're going to have computers that don't operate exactly the same. And that makes it more difficult to develop new operating systems that are really innovative because, all of a sudden they say, well, gee, what about this brand X Macintosh? We have to write our new software so it works not only on the computers that we make, but those other computers, which are really part of our families. So it makes it more complicated to do new innovative things and takes longer to do it. So Apple Apple finds itself in a tougher situation to beat Microsoft, which is really their competition in operating systems, to beat them with innovation, which has really been their strong point to date.
My guest is Stephen Levy, computer columnist for Newsweek. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with computer columnist Stephen Levy. You wrote a history of the Macintosh computer, and in that book, which has just been published in paperback, you write, very few tools transform their culture. Macintosh has been one of them. How did the Mac transform the culture?
Well, I think before the Mac, people understood that computers were important and understood that they were going to help us somehow access information and create things, using that information. But there was no real comfortable way to do it. The arcane commands you had to use, typing codes into the computer to get anything done, really put you at a distance between yourself and your information. And Macintosh really embodied the first way to get at that information in a very comfortable way, as easily as you access information by sitting at a desktop and physically interacting with it. And that idea had been out there before, but no one had really got it out to the public in a very amiable, easy to grasp manner. And that style of using information, that style of using a metaphor within the computer that related to the way you operate when you're not using a computer, is, I think, going to be the single way that people are going to, process and change and create with huge masses of information in the future. So I think that even though the Macintosh system itself one day might slip into history, the idea behind it is going to be everywhere. And we'll use, that idea to communicate not only with computers, but telephones and refrigerators and television sets.
Now, your book reminded me about the image computers used to have back in the 60s and the 70s, when computers meant large corporations storing data about you, or it meant the phone company processing your phone bill that said, do not fold, spindle, or mutilate on it. It was this whole sense of, like, anonymity. You're just a name in this big computer. And then we started getting computers of our own. Computers took on a completely different meaning.
Right. It's been kind of a Pac-Man maneuver. The computers, once we saw as these objects that depersonalized us and were used against us, suddenly fell into our hands, and we could, switch things around and have an incredible amount of leverage against these large institutions. I guess the best example about that, though it's not necessarily a very positive one, is of the lone computer hacker sitting in his bedroom with a low-cost computer, bringing huge institutions to their knees. It just gives an indication of the power one person with one of these devices can have. And, of course, there's a lot more benevolent kinds of applications, like allowing you to, for instance, to publish a newsletter or a small magazine, using a very small outlay in capital.
You got your first Macintosh demonstration in 1983. And what you saw really surprised you. What were some of the things that you saw?
Well, the first thing I was impressed by was the fact that, like a piece of paper, the background of a Macintosh was white. It was a light color, and you had dark writing. The letters and the drawings were dark on that. And, of course, I grew up using pieces of paper, and, I typed with pieces of paper. And that was something that was very comfortable and very accessible. And I'd always felt at a distance using my previous computer, which had those green phosphorescent letters that if you stared at for a long time, it was like looking at one of those eight balls you turn upside down and the letters would mistily come into view. And the second amazing thing was when the person demonstrating it to me had me type something into it, and we selected the type, and with one little click of the mouse, moved the type from regular looking type to an italic font. And that somehow just struck me as something marvelous had happened, because being a writer, I knew that previously the process it took to get the regular looking letters I'd write, the normal font, into an italic font, meant that you'd have to use a very expensive linotype machines and stuff you couldn't do in your own home. And all of a sudden I realized, with this machine, we're all publishers, we're all typesetters, and there's a huge range of things that we're going to be able to do now that we couldn't do before. So it isn't just making our lives easier, it's enabling us to do things that previously only professionals can do.
What was the research like in deciding how the point and click system would work, and how many buttons there should be on the mouse, and how many clicks it should have to make?
Yeah, one interesting thing I did in Insanely Great was try to document how the things you see when you use a computer don't just happen there. They're really the result of a lot of arguments and sometimes user testing, sometimes, one very vociferous, smart person within a group arguing for, a certain alternative. So I used an example, the amount of times that when you go to a word on the top of the screen, something called a menu bar, and you select an option, be it cut or, spell check or, paste or something, it blinks on the screen, gives you a little feedback to let you know you've selected it. Well, how many times will you blink the thing? Turned out to be a big question in the Macintosh team. And they had a huge argument about it before they finally decided on three times it's going to blink. You might have used the Macintosh for 10 years and never even noticed how many times it blinked. But they were so passionate about it that the people who lost the argument got a concession that users would be able to go to the control panel part of the operating system and adjust it. If they felt that three was, too many or too little, they could have it blink twice or four times.
Let me ask you a keyboard question. I've often heard that the reason computers have the kind of keyboards that they have is that they assumed everybody was used to using a typewriter and it would be too hard to break the typewriter habit. But were it not for typewriters, the whole way of using a computer would be completely different. How much truth is there behind that?
Well, certainly, they're based on typewriters because that's the way people get text into things. And we're really stuck with, a keyboard for the near-term future because, voice recognition, which would be another reasonable way to get, words into a computer, is somewhat far away. Pointing devices like the mouse give us other ways to get things into the computer. One thing which is very frustrating, to people who think about these things is that we're stuck with the keyboard layout, which was left over from the typewriter days.
Right.
And, the layout now, if you look into the history of the typewriter, is actually designed to slow down your fingers so you don't jam the keys of a typewriter. And, it would make sense for people to learn a better layout, a keyboard layout, like the Dvorak system is one that's known to, because you don't obviously have that limitation in speed when you're using a computer. You should be encouraged to let your fingers go as fast as they can because the computer can keep up with you. But, because this means that of using a keyboard layout, the standard is so ingrained, no one's had any success in convincing people to use a different one.
There are restaurants now that are computerized where the waiter or waitress uses their finger on the screen instead of a mouse or a tracking ball. Is that the wave of the future?
Well, I think the wave of the future is everything you could imagine that computer technology could be used, it will be used. At one point, that example you used would have been quite startling. Now it's, an oh sure situation. And I think that, as computers get even less expensive, get easier to use, people are going to find zillions of oh sure applications to integrate these things into their lives. I think we're going to lose the sense of really what a computer is because it's going to be so integrated. It's almost like a motor. We use motors in hundreds of different ways. You come in contact with them during the day, but we don't think when we get in an elevator or when we use a pencil sharpener, I'm using motor technology now. So I think that the computer is essentially going to disappear in that sense.
Where are the interesting innovations taking shape now?
I think the most interesting ones are network related, related to the internet, to the World Wide Web. About a year ago, I wrote an open letter to Michael Spindler, the head of Apple, suggesting that he make all his computers run on the internet with a simple click of the mouse, and build that into it, make it the one way that anyone could get on the internet and do all the exciting things on it without having a very difficult setup process that you have when you try to do that now. And there were people at Apple who wanted this to happen, but what happened instead was they put their resources into Apple creating a more traditional online service because they felt that little piece would be a profit center. They really didn't have the big picture. And now, about a month ago, I read that Bill Gates wanted to do what I suggested for his system, and eventually we're going to see the next version of Microsoft Windows try to get onto the internet automatically and do that idea. So that's an opportunity lost for Apple.
So you think that this is the big innovation on the way, easier ways of getting onto the internet and using the internet?
You know, you go to a computer show now, and it used to be everyone would say, well, what's the hot product? Is it a hot software product? Is it a hot hardware product? But now you look at it, and what's hot is people. Is what ways people could get connected with other people, what's called content, meaning, say, CD-ROMs or things where people, show their creativity in a way where it's easy to grasp. So I think that the industry has gotten mature to the point where, the real nuts and bolts aren't so much important as, people getting in contact with people or coming up with ideas to make other people think. And I think that's a great development.
Well, Stephen Levy, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Stephen Levy is a computer columnist for Newsweek and the author of a history of the Macintosh called Insanely Great. This is Fresh Air.